this year, it gets appropriated for bonded debt retirement. And that's the trade-off. In other words, to do this, and I also know that each year it's going to get less, because under this you can't have any new debt this way. That's the plus side of the bill. So, but it seems to me that there's got to be that upfront commitment by the legislature and the governor that if we do this, then by gum, the 80% should be funded in full.
Senator Binkley?
Well, I just wanted to make a correction. I think Senator Fisher said that what we said as a legislature was that we were going to pay 80% of school debt. That's not what the legislature says. Legislature says we will pay up to a maximum of 80%. Mm-hmm. Could be zero, could be 10%, could be 79%, could be 80%. Not going to be 81%, but it could be up to 80%. And that's the question that's on the ballot. That's what voters voted for. It's very clear in the language. It says up to 80%. And so, you know, I don't think that we've violated any spirit of any understanding of the electorate out there when they decided to take on the debt of those schools, and when legislators from urban areas decided, rather than making education a priority and funding those schools directly, that they would allow the communities to bond and come back. And in many cases, many school districts actually end up paying nothing by selling the bonds, by arbitraging the money, by getting some small direct appropriations from the legislature to offset the costs initially. They have a case where they're getting the school, the state is paying the school 100%. I think Seward's a case, for example, where we appropriated through legislative appropriation money for the construction, money for the, in effect, 20% that the local municipality was supposed to pay directly from the legislature, and then the other 80% or 76% or whatever comes back through the annual process of repaying debt. Yeah, there was an appropriation last year. Senator Curtula put it through.
Well, I think the Seward Elementary, is that what you're talking about?
That whatever the Seward school was,
okay. And we can get into this a little bit later if you want to really look at it. But the Seward Elementary was taken prior bond proceeds that were excess. But on those bond proceeds, you're still paying your debt, your local debt on it. So it wasn't that the state coughed up the whole 100%. It's still the municipality still has to pay. There was $2 million transfer, as I understand it, to the elementary school in Seward.
$2 million of general funds,
well,
as I recall.
No, $2 million of authorized or of bond money, which is still a debt of the municipality.
Well, it was general fund dollars. If that $2 million had not gone to the Seward facility, it would have gone into the general fund.
No, no, it would have stayed with the school district until they decided what to do with it.
Well, that was more my understanding last year.
Well, Senator Azaro.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe either one of the sponsors could answer this. I'm trying to figure out how the criteria would be based for need on health and safety. Because I can see a small school, let's take Olechnicek, for example, and that's one that's most recent, where the roof collapsed. And maybe you've got 25, 30 students out there. You've got a limited amount of money available to take care of that problem. And let's say that you have another roof collapse in a classroom in Anchorage, where you've got 2,500 students, and they're both competing for that same amount of money. I don't feel comfortable in saying there that the school in Olechnicek is going to get taken care of.
Mr. Chairman, that's the very reason that if you look on the differences between 37 and 100, that the number of students would not be considered. All that was removed in the language of the bill, so that what you're trying to address there, let me give you how that issue came about. Under the present priority listing right now, under both systems, that the DOE categorizes those priorities and those school construction needs, for instance, under number one. The only criteria that's now used as to where they appear on the list is by the number of students. That is the criteria that's used. For instance, under priority one, and then you get a listing of 1 through 20, it happens to be the number of students affected is the way that those lists are put together. And under this bill, that removes that.
But I still don't see how a strong argument is going to be made when you've actually got X number of dollars available for both projects, and it's got to go to one or the other, how a stronger argument is going to be made for those smaller schools out there as opposed to a school that's got 2,500 kids. I mean, it's just, it doesn't balance out. I mean, it hasn't been in the past, and I don't see how it's going to carry through in the future.
Mr. Chairman, there's two ways that that's going to be addressed. First of all, under this bill, everybody's going to have adequate insurance. The second thing is, and let me give you, when we debated this number of students, Representative McClain gave me the most convincing argument. For instance, if you take a Lignigate, how many other gymnasiums happen to be in a Lignigate? There isn't but one. If you take the city of Anchorage, for instance, and they had a similar gym, they have other alternatives in which to go to. I asked Eileen McClain if, for instance, when we debated this, is if a school happened to burn in Nowitzki and a school happened to burn in Barrow, which one would you want to fund first? Say you had 36 kids in Nowitzki and 150 in Point Barrow, and she automatically said, well, Nowitzki. And I said, why? She said, because there are no other alternatives in Nowitzki, where in Point Barrow we've got other facilities that we could juggle things around. So our highest priority would be the smaller school. And so, and that's one of the things that frankly bothers the larger municipalities. So, I mean, everybody is trying to be addressed in this bill on a standard of fairness and what is going to be addressed for highest priorities for our kids at the state level. And under the way this is structured, frankly, the rural areas, I think, are going to be treated more than fair.
Mr. Chairman, maybe... if we're talking about fairness, maybe the thing to do is to combine this bill and to combine the thoughts there of the previous legislatures in debt retirement. And I've got schools under both programs. And fund debt retirement this year, put the whole thing under the Board of Education, and then prioritize from there next year. Base it on need, health and safety. If we have schools that were built right now that don't follow or meet this criteria, then why should we be paying that back? We ought to be out there taking care of the basic needs of students. And I can give you stories there that'll coin the phrase from Representative Hagen there that will make your hair hurt.
Mine already does.
You know? But maybe we need to take a look at the whole thing. You know, we're not building Taj Mahals out there in rural Alaska. Those are basic schools. You don't walk into a new school out in a rural area. I'm trying to think of a new school that's been built, and I can't think of one in my district there in rural areas, so I can't use it as an example. You don't walk up the steps in that new school and have to walk through a series of columns just to get into it. I mean, it's a practical school. It's the old red schoolhouse. It's not a fancy building.
It's a little bell. A
little bell on top.
Russian Orthodox
in the back.
They have to walk 5 miles to get there.
And you have to wait till May before you can get to the swimming pool.
You get slate boards. And
Mr. Chairman, the only response I have is that this is a 2.5-year product in which rural and urban people have tried to come together to address the concerns that Senator Zarro has mentioned and also the concerns of Senator Fisher. I don't want to steal somebody else's quote, but it is not a perfect bill. It's the very best that we could do, but I would submit to you that if we don't take some positive action to, number one, curb the debt, and number two, try to find a fair and equitable way and take politics out of funding schools, it's not going to get better. It's going to get worse.
Senator Binkley, and then we're running out of time.
We're going to hold just bill on over. That last point, taking the politics out of funding school, couldn't the same argument be made from the foundation formula also? I mean, I know a lot of people have concerns about the foundation formula. I know the single and dual site school districts is a question, the geographic differential. Would it make sense to have the Department of Education and the state school board just do the foundation formula also? Just appropriate the money to them and say, split it up how you think fair among all the 56 school districts around the state, and we won't allow politics to get involved in it, and we'll just sit back and just appropriate a lump sum of $447 million general fund to the Department of Education, and you can decide how it ought to be split up among the school districts.
Well, I guess that would be stretching it, in my opinion, Mr. Chairman, to try to use that parable. From my perspective, I have not tried to address the school foundation issue. What I've tried to do is try to get a handle on what the school construction needs are for the state. I think that's a totally separate debate.
Okay. Senator Fisher?
Do you want to address the amendment? I don't think there was any objections to the amendment.
At this point, we're going to hold the bill over.
Fine. Mr. Chairman, we would want to work with you on any of these issues. As I say, this is a priority bill. I was amazed to see it pass the House with only two objections, and it's a priority bill, I think, for this session. So we'll be happy to work with you and appreciate your scheduling. Thank you.
Thank you very much. At this point, we're going to go up and take up neighborhood revitalization, but I'd like to talk about the capital budget.
Let's do the capital.
Senator Bank, should we do the capital budget at this point?
Yeah, we've only got a couple minutes left.
Yeah. We're running out of time.
Let's fund some of those schools. Get the capital budget.
I've got a list of the options on the capital budget. It's something that we need to talk about in caucus today, and I just wanted to get some sort of general discussion on that.
Capital caucus.
Capital caucus.
Make your hair hurt. Try acupuncture.
He's got bing, 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 bing.
I'll put it back.
I wonder if that would work for hair growth.
Whatever he
had. Try it.
Yin yang. That's his guy. Jim, where's your brother that's going to build the courthouse?
Are there any comments on this?
comments on this?
Essentially, what we're talking about is approximately right now about a $20 million general match dollar amount that we're talking about as far as what's needed for general funds, matching with federal funds.
Mm-hmm. What does that bring in?
I'd have to look it up. It's quite a bit.
Yeah.
$280 million, if I'm not mistaken. But whether the caucus is, there's some discussion whether there's a caucus today or not. A caucus just today. I don't think it's really been determined. But the point is that we need to proceed with some of these things, and I want people to start thinking about what they do plan to do with the capital budget. Senator Fisher?
No, I'm just wondering how this works out. In other words, the $20 million is general fund. How much federal dollars, how many federal dollars does that capture?
Approximately 10 to 1, so it's about $200 million.
But we have $1 million capital budget. $100 million, rather.
But that doesn't include federal funds. That's,
just
general funds.
Okay, I'm just trying to... Okay.
$100 million is the general prognosis that we've been dealing with. Now, whether we want to fund that at $90 million or $100 or $85, Senator Pershaw has been working on some of the governor's priorities. What I would suggest the committee do is look these over, just give it some thought to look it over and see what you want to do on the capital budget. And if it's working it out Senate district by Senate district, working with the House members, a certain allocation, whatever that may be.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Binkley?
How does this work in with the proposed capital expenditure of the Rail Belt Energy Fund? What is the status of
that? There's no relationship on this particular capital budget.
Is the status of the Rail Belt Energy Fund deal?
Well, it's basically just, there's been a lot of talk about it, but there's been no consensus on it.
Okay.
Senator Duncan?
No, that's right. I have no questions.
That's Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fisher.
So I understand it that the $20 million, that will be matched, okay, but the matching in that whole situation does not fit in any of these schemes. In other words, that's a given.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't come out of any particular district at all. It doesn't apply towards the district, right?
Funny River Bridge.
What are you getting out of it?
Probably not much.
Funny River Bridge.
No, that should be held harmless.
Okay, that's for discussion. We also have people from Neighborhood Revitalization that are here, too. And we're a little short on time. I know you got here at 10:30. Did you want to just give a presentation today and see if we can kind of come up to the table?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Tim Benintendi, and I'm representing Representative Dave Donnelly this morning for the House Labor and Commerce Committee. I'll be available to answer any questions from that end of it, but we have others present to support the legislation this morning. Ms. Cynthia Parker is the Executive Director of the Anchorage Neighborhood Housing Services. Mr. Jim Kubitz is here from the Anchorage Assembly, and he's a former board member. And Mr. Mark Begich is also here from the Anchorage Assembly.
Thank you. Cynthia? Paul?
Thank you, Senator Ewing. I'm Cynthia Parker, and I'm the Executive Director of Anchorage Neighborhood Housing Services. I believe the bill that you have before you conforms the House bill to the Senate bill, which was passed out of this committee last week. This is a program which essentially would set up on a statewide basis the ability for communities to access the Neighborhood Revitalization Corporation. And it's something that, as I had mentioned in my previous testimony, has worked very successfully in Anchorage. I have with me also a resolution from the Fairbanks City Council, which supports the concept of the program. And we would urge that the Finance Committee adopt this, the changes that are proposed. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions on it? Yes. Are there any questions for Cynthia Parker? Okay. Does anybody else want to testify on the bill? Senator Rohde?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman. As has been previously noted, the bill you have before you has been amended to exactly duplicate the Senate version of the bill. The concern that Senator Fisher had has also been dealt with after there will be no grants that are inappropriate. Assemblyman Begich spent a great deal of time on it, and the staff has worked very hard. I think it's a good vehicle that will meet the committee's approval.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fisher, we're running out of time. We're going to go down the session.
Is there going to be a proposed amendment, or am I reading the bill wrong?
This bill's going to be held over, Senator Fisher.
Oh, it is? Okay. We can address it. It is in your packet. I didn't realize, Mr. Chairman, but there is a whole amendment that's being offered from Senator Rohde's office. I'm sorry.
Since we've already done Senate Bill 135 and we've got the amendments which make it the same, why can't we just go ahead and amend it and get it out?
Senator Pierce, the bill is going to be held over until tomorrow.
But we will do it tomorrow.
We'll see, Senator Pierce. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Meeting's adjourned. Meeting's called to order. Today is Thursday, April 20th. Great to have an audience out there today, since we don't always have one. At the table, we have Senator Binkley, Senator Duncan, and Senator Zaroff. And the first bill on the committee will be urging the Alaska Housing Marketing Council to develop a statewide housing policy for the decade of the 1990s. Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 27. This is Senator Rohde's resolution. It was been worked out between myself, Senator Rohde, and Senator Pierce. Senator Zaroff.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we had this resolution before us here
was about a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was put into a subcommittee along with
28.
SGR 28. Were the differences there?
Right. We went ahead, and there's a memo. Everybody should have a memo in front of them. And it says, both signed by Senator Rohde and myself, which we agree that both resolutions should remain substantially intact and should not be combined, because there are two different policies. We've gotten the agreement with the Alaska Housing Marketing Council and with AHFC and with all other parties that they both are compatible. So both of them are ready. Senator Zaroff.
Mr. Chairman, we had extensive discussion on these resolutions last time. If there is no further testimony, if you're ready for a motion, I would make a motion.
Ready for a motion.
Senate
Concurrent Resolution 27. Senator Zaroff.
I would move and ask unanimous consent that the Senate Concurrent Resolution 27 be moved out of the committee with individual recommendations. And do you want the accompanying fiscal note?
Yes, Senator Zaroff.
And the accompanying fiscal note.
Okay, the bill. Is there any objection to the motion? Bill moved out with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note. Next resolution is Senate Concurrent Resolution 28. Senator Duncan, Senator Menkley.
Is this substantially the same as the
exactly the one we dealt with when we passed out before after we rescinded our action?
No objection. Mr. Chairman, I'd move CS or CS?
You want to move the committee substitute?
CS for Senator Resolution 28.
Okay, the only question is a motion to move the bill out with the individual recommendations. Is there objection? The bill moves. Next bill on the calendar is that one did have a zero fiscal note. committee substitute for House Bill Number 160 on neighborhood revitalization. I believe the concerns were taken care of by Senator Rohde on this bill, having to do with neighborhood revitalization.
As long as I like it.
Okay, is Mark Baggage here? Mark, do we have, if you could come to the table, please. I have a memo dated April 15th for the members of the Senate Finance Committee. Are there amendments that need to be added to the House bill that are before us?
Mr. Chairman, the attached amendments, there's a page and a quarter should be amended, so we have this bill similar to the SB 135 that you passed out earlier.
Okay, so that bill had already passed out of our Senate Finance Committee about a week ago or 2 weeks ago.
Correct.
Okay, so what we're going to have to do essentially is incorporate these amendments into the House Committee substitute, make it a Senate Finance Committee substitute, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Zaroff?
Mr. Chairman, do you want to have the committee substitute then for us?
Right. Why don't you go ahead and move, Senator Zaroff, the committee substitute for House Bill Number 160, Finance, that's before us. Move for adoption of that, and then what we'll do is we'll add our amendment and make it a Senate committee substitute.
Chairman, I would so move.
Okay. Senator Zaroff has moved to adopt committee substitute for House Bill Number 160, Finance. Is there objection to that? There's no objection. It's before us. We have amendments dated April 15th, 1989, which will be incorporated into the committee substitute. Senator Zaroff.
Just a question up there. Then, Mr. Chairman, these amendments then make the House bill then say basically the same thing that we had passed out previously?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I would move.
Did we discuss the fiscal note on this? This neighborhood revitalization.
We have to check
where these two
on the
new
fiscal
positions
note.
Are going to be located. Is there a zero fiscal note with this, Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Senator Binkley, what that would essentially do by putting these amendments into the bill, it will make it a zero fiscal note.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Senators are off.
I would move the amendments listed on the memo from Senator Rohde, dated April 15th, and have them incorporated in the committee substitute for House Bill 160.
Okay, is there objection to that? So ordered. Right.
There's no objection to that. Senator Fisher?
No, I have another amendment that I'd like to have the committee look at. It's actually on the bill. It's taking out two words.
What two words?
If you'd want to look in page 2, line 19 and 20, the concern that I had was that the grants do not go to anything other than a nonprofit. And if you take out the word two projects, then that clarifies that. Projects would be getting loans. They wouldn't be getting grants. And I think Mark is aware of that. So if you just take out the word two projects, if they give them priority in the award of grant in 1, 2, 3, 4,
yeah.
But you take out projects, because the projects are not supposed to be getting grants. It's a nonprofit corporation that should be getting the grants.
Discussion?
Page 2, line 20.
Oh, I got you.
That's acceptable.
That is acceptable? Okay, there's Senator Fisher, is that an amendment to the amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would move that to be incorporated with the other amendment for committee's substitute.
Okay, is there objection to the amendment to the amendment? Amendment to the amendment passes. Now the full package of the amendments are before us, incorporated in the Finance Committee substitute. Senator Zaroff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that we report out of committee substitute for House Bill 160, amended finance with a zero fiscal. Would that be a new committee substitute then? As a new committee substitute.
As a new committee substitute. Is there objection to the bill moving out as a new committee substitute by the Senate Finance Committee, as stated? So it's Senate Committee Substitute Finance Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 160. Is there objection to that? The bill moves with a zero fiscal note, new fiscal note from the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. The next bill I'd like to bring up is the House Bill Number 105 on seatbelts for discussion. So we're going to have to, should be in your file. As I recall, there was some discussion on the question of which committee substitute was going to be talked about here. And we had a transportation version of the committee substitute for House Bill Number 105. We also had a committee substitute for House Bill 105 Judiciary. Do we have any discussion on the on the bill? Senator Frank?
Mr. Chairman, did we ever hear from Paul Roller with the Division of Insurance on the suggested language by Representative Grunberg?
We had some of the insurance industry here, but we have not talked to Mr. Roller at this point. And Mr. Roller's not here. Senator Duncan? I think what happens is it got way late on the schedule and then he never came up. But
see, my question is, what is his position on Representative Grunberg's amendment?
Because to me, it seems Mr. Roller over here.
That seems to be the it's in his hands. He's the one that's charged with the responsibility of approving insurance rates, increases or decreases, I guess. And, I'd like to know his views on that so that I can.
Okay, what's the pleasure of the committee at this point? Is it to get Mr. Roller here and discuss that today or tomorrow? Senator Pierce.
Yeah, I didn't know you were going to bring this up today, and I do want to offer an amendment that would take away the exemption for emergency vehicles. So.
Okay, let's check and see what our schedule is going to look like here so that we can get those people over.
Mr. Chairman, I don't mind moving the bill, but I just
I thought we were going to take that one up, if that amendment up. If we're not going to take the amendment up, if nobody else has any interest in taking that amendment up, then I don't.
Do.
You do.
Oh, the insurance amendment?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. And also school buses. We haven't
Senator
really
Beckley.
Discussed that, really, seatbelts in school buses, as I recall. That, I have several questions on that issue, and I know there was somebody earlier here from the Department of Education. I don't know if they're still here or not. Earlier when we had testimony on the legislation.
I'm ready to vote on that.
Senator Pierce, what's the amendment that you're speaking of on the seatbelt bill?
Pardon? Oh, I want to move to amend so that we don't exempt emergency vehicles, but I just need to know which CS we're going to be using so I can have my amendment ready tomorrow.
Okay, why don't we move this down to the bottom of the calendar, and we'll see if we can get that. Senator?
Yeah, maybe we could ask Mr. Roller to come over and talk about that briefly. If Senator Binkley's going to offer the amendment, or whoever's going to offer it, if it's going to be offered, then I guess I'd like to hear his views on it.
Okay.
Do we
we're going to have to get Mr. Roller over here.
I'm here to discuss. I don't have the specific amendment drafted, but I think it's important to discuss it.
Senator Pierce?
Which CS?
Well, that's what we're going to have to do is deal with which committee substitute. I think we've got a Transportation Committee substitute and a Judiciary Committee substitute. Transportation would be the most recent one. I believe would be the one that we would deal with would be the Transportation version. Senator Zaroff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would hope there that we could get somebody here that could address the insurance aspect of this here, not from the respect there that Senator Binkley was mentioning, but from the perspective there of an accident. A person can be involved in a two-car accident, and the vehicle, passengers in one car may not be at fault, but they may not be wearing their seat belts, and as a result, their claims are not going to be honored because they were not wearing seat belts. And I think that's a real important issue. I think this is probably some tort reform legislation for insurance companies. And I'm a little bit concerned about that, and we need to have that addressed. And there are some legal questions in here that I think this bill goes much further than just wearing seat belts. And we need to get that addressed.
Senator Binkley, Mr. Roller is on his way over here.
Some questions for the EMS people. I know we were cut short last time, didn't have a chance to really question them. I was curious about any potential savings to the EMS organization as far as their grants. If we are able to enact some mandatory seatbelt legislation that would, you know, obviously cut down on the number of accidents and the number of responses that they would have to make in those regards.
At this point, I think we're going to wait for Mr. Roller is on his way over here, although he was before the committee twice before, but he is on his way. Why don't we go ahead and put this at the bottom of the calendar for today? That's all right. We'll go ahead and take up the next bill, Senate Bill 38, until these people get assembled here. Senate Bill 38 is the early funding bill for education. Senator Fisher had it in subcommittee last week. We now have a new dollar amount, which is on the education bill. Senator Fisher, do you want to speak to your committee substitute?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, you all recall that we had a caucus, and this is really following the will of the caucus. I would prefer, of course, full funding, but the caucus did not go with the full funding. So what we did after the caucus meeting, of course, we came back and adjusted the figures in accordance with what the caucus wanted. And I'm not happy with it, Mr. Chairman, but I also realize there is some compromise and you have to be some give. So this reflects the caucus decision, and I'd like to see it move so we can give the message out there that the Senate isn't just sitting on our duff when it comes to schools, that we are moving with the getting close to the end. So the change, of course, there was a reduction in the foundation of 1%. And there was a reduction in what I would really like to see in pupil transportation by approximately $5 million.
Senator Frank?
What did you say on the pupil transportation?
Pardon?
What did you say on the pupil transportation?
The pupil transportation
No, the pupil transportation stayed the same. It's the bonded debt retirement that went down $5 million.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And you may recall that this same bill, this committee substitute, was presented to the whole caucus, so everybody out front, and we took each issue as backup material so the caucus could review the whole situation. And you may recall the one vote for what was it, $104 million for bonded debt. That was turned down by the caucus.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Binkley, a couple of questions. Who was on that subcommittee, the subcommittee in finance on this bill?
Who was it? Myself?
Carol? Okay, thank you.
We'll check and see. Senator Fisher, it was you and someone else raised their hand, as I recall.
As I recall, I was appointed to that subcommittee, but I don't recall having any meetings with Senator Fisher or anybody else, for that matter, on this particular bill, but we can check for the record. And, of course, we did go over this in caucus and determine that we would be reducing the governor's proposed increment by exactly $5 million in caucus, that as well as other provisions of the budget. I know there are, you know, virtually all of the major categories of the budget and, of course, the caps in the different departments we made an initial determination on. But, of course, I don't recall the caucus saying go out and pass a bill on this next week or tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. There were many areas of the budget that we determined, municipal assistance, revenue sharing, many other categories, and you know, that's a far cry from actually passing a bill and taking a substantial portion of the budget and passing it before the rest of the budget is passed. So I guess those are some of my concerns. You know, with the bill as it comes before us today, I guess I don't see why we're actually proposing.
Senator Duncan.
Any other, just to follow up on what Mr. Minkley said, I just did a quick computation here, whether I agree with it or not, as far as reduction in education. I think the caucus vote was to reduce the increment by $5 million exactly, as I recall. And the difference in the two general fund amounts here are only $4,484,000, so it's about $550,000 difference between $5 million.
No, it was five. I've got the sheets. And I see, Mr. Chairman, that the subcommittee was Senator Fisher, Senator Binkley, myself, Senator Zaroff, Senator Duncan, and Senator Yulee. And I don't know if the four or five of you met, but I know I never was called in.
Senator Fisher.
It appears to me that the caucus supersedes any subcommittee, and if the caucus says something, that's it, and there's no need to go ragging it around. The caucus had made a decision. I don't agree with the caucus decision, but it was a caucus decision, and that's why this bill's before us. It's a caucus decision, and I don't think any subcommittee should be able to change the caucus's voted position. And we voted in public on this issue in the caucus, and that makes a big difference. So everybody here did have a chance to vote, and we just took it back and...
Mr. President, or I'm sorry, I'm still used to being on the floor, so I apologize. In caucus, it seems to me we talked, if I'm not mistaken, Senator Duncan, about a 1% reduction to the foundation formula program. Is that correct?
No, $5 million. I'll go get the papers. Well, here, Senator Gould has got it right here.
No mention of $5
million in
foundation.
But the motion,
Senator,
is foundation right there.
Okay. Senator.
$24 million and $5,000. Increment, which is actually $5 million less than what the governor's proposed increment was.
Okay, Senator Binkley, so what are you saying? That $5 million was the correct figure?
Yeah, $5 million was the correct figure, but I mean, it doesn't matter what the correct figure was anyhow. I mean, the caucus didn't say go up there tomorrow and pass the early funding bill. You know, they didn't say either go up there and pass municipal assistance tomorrow or pass revenue sharing or pass any other measure in the
budget. That's at the discretion of the Finance Committee.
Yeah,
on what they want to do. Senator Frank?
Are we arguing about the difference between $4.7 million and $5 million? Is that right, Senator Binkley?
Well, several things I guess we're arguing about.
No, I mean, just on the dollar.
Discussing. One, we're talking about who's on the subcommittee that actually, you know, worked on this piece of legislation. Another is, you know, why is the legislation before us? And the third question is, the numbers are wrong if we're trying to mirror what the caucus had wanted us to do in the operating budget.
Senator Frank, we're going to need to take a brief at ease here.
Well, just let me ask you a question. Am I right that we are talking about 5 versus 4.7? Is that right?
Yeah, it was reduced by $5 million. The governor's increment was reduced.
Right.
Which is approximately 1%.
Right. Okay. I guess it's a matter of whether it's approximately 1% or I don't know where the 5 came up from. I don't know where that came up from, but I thought we were voting on 1%, and I didn't do a separate calculation in caucus to confirm that that $5 million was 1%. I had assumed that it was,
it came,
that it was
Mr.
1%.
Chairman, but. It came similarly to the extra $1.5 million in CNRA, the $1.5 million in public safety, the $2 million in fish and game. I think they were all fairly arbitrary numbers.
Okay, so I actually, I'm told that it's really $4,477,000 versus $5,000. So we're talking a little over $500,000 or half a million. Okay. Well, I guess I don't have a big problem in changing that, although I would support the draft that's before us. But it seems to me that it was sold as a 1% cut to caucus.
It is approximately 1%. I don't know what the percentage, let's see. Difference of 400 and how many thousand dollars?
It's a difference of $4,477,589 versus $5 million. So
it's $533 million.
Thousand.
Or, yeah, 533,000 out of, that's maybe 0.1%.
Yeah, it's, so it's, you know, like I said,
Senator,
I don't think we need should quibble over it one way or the other.
Senator Duncan.
Sure. I don't necessarily want to quibble. It's an important point because there are also limits set on every operating budget category, and I just assume be able to budget a little bit here and there on all those also. And I think it's an important point that we need to determine as to whether we're going to follow strictly the guidelines or if we're going to do something differently. And I know there's some problem areas to get into consideration here. And I fully support education funding, but you start off
with
the
guidelines
you need to
follow,
I think.
Chairman,
Senator Fisher.
Two things. One is the vote was on 1%, and it happens to be 1% is 1.4 million and not 5. And that's what the caucus vote was. It wasn't on 5. It may have been discussed 5, but the vote was strictly 1% of whatever it was. The other thing is if we're going to take the position that we got to look at everything, then we should not pass one single bill out of here that has a fiscal note because it's going to impact the budget. We're all talking, I mean, it's going to come off somewhere, so we shouldn't be passing any bills with fiscal notes if we're talking about an impact on the budget. We already passed a couple out today that have fiscal notes. Now, at what point do we say, hey, wait a minute, because that's going to have to come from somewhere. This is one that's been around. We had plenty of hearings on it, but this is the one that the caucus specifically voted on. That's what makes the difference. And if we don't want to listen to the caucus, then, Mr. Chairman, we shouldn't even have any caucus. It just seems asinine to sit there and vote publicly and then come up here and say, well, we don't agree with the public vote.
Senator Frank?
I think we should move the bill as well. Again, I
didn't hear that, Senator Frank. What did you say?
I said I think we should move the bill as well. I think that whether we move it out with the strict 1% proposed or whether we move it out with $5 million, I could accept it either way. But we did pass the early funding legislation earlier. I think the caucus has made a strong position on the issue, and I don't see anything wrong with moving the bill forward. I think it's early funding for education is something that we've already passed the legislation saying we'd do. And we are behind our schedule. We were supposed to pass early education by the April 7th. And so I don't have a problem at all moving with it. In fact, I fully support it moving it along.
Senator Zaroff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I could ask a sponsor here, or get the question during the IDs. But for the early funding for education there, of course, makes everybody out there feel comfortable that they've got their funding in place for education programs for next year, and that's fine. But there is a concern there because I don't think that everybody is treated equal. And the concern stems from another piece of legislation that's floating around on the single and dual site schools. There is a concern out there that with whatever funding formula you put together, that there are schools out there that are not being treated fairly. And I asked this question when I saw this bill being voted around last night. But I think we need to address to make sure that all
children in this state here are being treated fairly. All school districts are being treated fairly. I know the department has some problems with the dual site, that there may be some excess funding there. I would like to see them taken care of. I want to get early funding out as well as anybody else, but let's take a look at if there's any problems. We've been fine-tuning this funding formula for a number of years now. And that's basically what we're doing. We're still fine-tuning. We're getting the message that everybody, there is a small segment out there that is just a little bit offbeat. And those are the single-site schools. We need to take care of that.
Let's take a brief knee. Senator Fisher said a couple of important points, I think. One, the vote in the caucus was whether or not to support the Finance Committee proposal, which is this that Senator Petula has right here. That was what the vote was, which includes a $5 million reduction in the proposed increment that the governor offered. The second thing is the vote was not on whether or not to fund education early. The vote was, do we support the Finance Committee proposal for the budget? We've got scheduled the budget bill, which will include this $642 million, for next week on the floor. I don't see any purpose in moving out one-third almost of the operating budget 1 week early for the purposes of show. It may not even get to the floor before the budget does. We don't even know. You got Rules Committee to go through and many other considerations. So I don't see the point. I think the point is that this was not a caucus decision to pass early funding on education. The only caucus decision was, do we support the Finance Committee proposal, which reduced the increment by $5 million and set the cap for the various agencies within the budget? The only thing, other vote that we took down in caucus was, what should the debt service be? Should it be reduced to $103.3 million versus $109 million? And that vote did fail. Those are the only two votes that I remember in the caucus. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Duncan.
This is an important issue to resolve, and as I look at the sheet, the reason it becomes very important to resolve is because there was a summary sheet passed out that says Senate cap general fund summary. And the Department of Education shows a Senate cap of $622,639,800, a $6,300,500 difference between the Senate and the governor. And if this number is not to be exact with what was on this sheet, then that means we're going to have to come back to the committee and squeeze another $550,000 out of the agency itself or out of the program in the agency to meet the Senate cap. And that can be very difficult to do, can be very damaging to the agency and other programs that agency administers, because the bottom line is going to be, when we go back to caucus, the bottom line is going to be, did we meet that cap or did we not meet that cap? And if we're willing to raise the cap to $515,000, then that's fine. That's a decision that the caucus, I think, has to make. And the impact of this action right now could cause that to happen, or we have to squeeze more out of the agency. That's the concern I have. And I just want to be sure we've understood before we went ahead.
Okay, let's take it easy. Okay, we're back to order. We've got a couple other bills on the calendar here. At this point, we're going to recess the meeting at the call of the chair. Meeting's called back to order. Dr. Joseph Stanislaw is here, and we're going to have a presentation on oil pricing from Dr. Stanislaw from Cambridge Energy Research Group.
The floor is mine?
Yeah, the floor is yours, Senator. We'll call you an honorary senator, doctor.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here as always, and I want to take this opportunity to again give my regrets for unfortunately not being able to make it back in early February. Although, given as cold as it was where I started from, I'm probably pleased I didn't actually get here the way it sounded, how cold it was. But I am pleased to be here now. I must say in that comment that I've been here a number of times thanks to all of you, and this is the first time I've actually come in and not had any difficulty. Even in the better times of years, I had a hard time getting in, so I'm happy to be here in one piece as such. And in another sense, I'm not quite so happy to be here because of the fact I have to speak to you about the price of oil, and so much seems to be happening in the world oil market. It's a market that continues to surprise just about everyone. Not so much on those things we like to forecast about or we can actually think we can plan about, but those surprises and those unforeseen events. I was walking with someone in another oil capital just 2 days ago, which was Tuesday, and saying, just think, if we had sat down a year ago and said, what could go wrong in the next year that would send the prices either way up or way down? You could have thought of a handful of things that might have sent the prices in one way or another, but no way could you have forecast the 7 or 8 or 9 accidents in the oil supply system that has sent the prices in one direction, straight up. And unfortunately, I hate to use the term, but two of the accidents were against two of the pillars on which the entire Western world has based its energy security system, Alaska and the North Sea. And the past three weeks alone, the pillar of Alaska was hit by a different type of accident, unfortunately, and then Brent in the North Sea had a major problem late Tuesday night, which is still causing uncertainty as to how North Sea supplies will be affected. And thus we see what's happening to prices. Prices continue to step in an upward direction. I like to think I could say confidently to you, had Valdez not happened, had Brent not happened 2 days ago, the price of oil would probably be a good dollar, if not $2, if not at least $2 lower than it currently is. But the events did happen. And those two events are going to have a long-term effect on the market, and you'll have a very strong short-term effect. It's interesting to think about these events and how, in many respects, they have telescoped into a very short time frame a lot of issues and factors the oil market didn't think it would be experiencing or witnessing for a good number of years. It's interesting to think right now, here we are in April 1989, the world basically still has a surplus of oil. And what are we talking about again in the halls of Congress in Washington? Increased energy efficiency when we have a surplus of energy. New views about reducing our imports of oil into the United States to mitigate possible other problems or accidents that may come along and down the road. That was almost beyond heard of that we're maybe discussing this sort of thing right now. Also with these unfortunate accidents and what's happening to price and pushing price up, one has to put it in perspective of OPEC itself, an organization that in the past year has announced reserve additions of over 200 billion barrels. 200 billion barrels is a lot of oil. 200 billion barrels means that the world could consume 10 million barrels a day more each year for the next 20 years, over and above what we already consume. And we consume right now 50 million barrels. Now, why do I talk about OPEC and its increased reserve additions in the same breath as I do discussing new discussion in Washington about enhancing and improving energy efficiency? Because basically the OPEC message is that they would like to see oil become once again the engine of economic growth. There is a lot of it in the system. There's a lot of gas in the system. And they want to be in a cooperative mode, in a cooperative fashion, to create a market environment in which that oil can compete and will compete well into the next decade, into the next century. But bang, all of a sudden two accidents happen which are beginning to change the mentality and the attitude by which we consume energy. That is, push on energy conservation, energy efficiency again. Washington is talking about accelerating the miles per gallon standards. That's quite about turn, given last August the Department of Transport rolled back, relaxed the efficiency standard for cars in the U.S. The EPA is talking about a goal, only talk right now, a goal of a 45 mile per gallon average car that's produced in the year 2000. And it could go even stronger than that. We have technology that can bring those cars on to even higher efficiency rates than 45 miles per gallon. But it's almost incongruous in light of the extra surplus OPEC has announced in the past year. With that in mind, let's step back a little bit and think about the oil market and what's happening with OPEC itself. There have been dramatic changes in the oil market in the past 9 months. I think the singularly most important change in the world oil market is OPEC itself, and it's the Secretariat of OPEC that has changed dramatically in the past 9 months. They have a new Secretary General. They had an acting Secretary General before for the past 4 years. The new Secretary General himself is a very charismatic man. He is contagious with his optimism. When he's interviewed by the world's press, it's hard for the world's press not to have positive adjectives when they write about what Mr. Subroto says. But also he has a different sense and a different mission. which is organizing the organization differently. When the OPEC ministers now meet, they meet as a board of directors, and they have all the analysis done for them, which they can then discuss, debate, and argue about. A year ago, they would do a lot of the homework themselves at the actual meeting, which make for disruptive meetings. So the attitude has changed because of the style of an approach to problem solving. And the countries of OPEC themselves are in a much more cooperative mode right now for very important internal political reasons. The best way to highlight that is the problems that Algeria faced back in the autumn, that Venezuela faced 2 or 3 weeks after the current new president was inaugurated. These countries have a strong vested interest in trying to make OPEC work and to have prices somewhat higher. OPEC itself has a new objective, to try and change the world's image of OPEC, that OPEC has a lot of oil, wants to be a secure and reasonable supplier of oil to the world, and a stable supplier of oil to the world. OPEC, in fact, is invoking language from its original charter, written back in 1960 and 61. If I'm not mistaken, I think it's Article 3, but I could be wrong in that. The charter actually says, we have formed ourselves, OPEC, to be a supplier of oil to the main consuming countries on a long-term basis at reasonable prices. That's a different OPEC from the OPEC we all knew in the 1970s, which was an OPEC that was in confrontation with the main consuming countries of the world, not in cooperation. This is the spirit they want to achieve and move towards. And again, you're going to find OPEC in a different mode, which is to start discussing cooperation about energy and the environment. But there is a big problem looming in the 1990s with respect to the environment, be it sulfur, be it the nitrogen oxides, be it CO2, energy has a primary role to play in cleaning up the environmental problem. And OPEC is saying it can cooperate, and it wants to cooperate with the consuming companies and governments to find a solution to these problems. Thinking about that, and thinking about solutions to the problems, one has to just throw out and mention the new discovery that seems to have been made, not yet proven, which is coal fusion, which if it's true, and no one knows at this point in time, it's all speculation, could have a remarkable impact on the world energy balance and the world energy scene. But it's one also that has telescoped right to today in April, the month in which we've had two major accidents to the world oil supply system. The announcement about a possible new breakthrough with the technology that could, guess what, relieve us of imported oil and also be environmentally clean. This has got to be described as a possible nightmare to an oil-producing province or an oil-producing state where, in the Middle East, all you have is oil. You don't have any other resource except for sand, and you can't sell sand right now. There has to be concern. This concern was not thought to be that important for a good 5 or 6 years. This technology that's being discussed now in the newspapers and scientific community may not be real, but it just brings to the forefront the importance that technology can play, and that oil may face competitors from many unknown directions as you move out in time. With that, let me turn to think about right now the oil market, think a little bit about demand with you and supply, and then get into that basic question of the price of oil, which I know is so important to you and to your committee. In thinking about the price of oil right now, I've given all of you a handout with many pictures that describe our view of the fundamentals of supply and demand. I've also given you a 2.5-page note on the current state of the market, given the new disruption to supply, the Brent problem, and how that's affecting both psychology for holding primary inventories as well as secondary inventories, and the impact that will have on price. My comments will obviously touch on many things in there, but will not be addressing the detailed words as such. I want to start with this picture, which is in your handout, which I believe are two paradoxes in today's oil market. The first paradox is that we are in a world of stability with volatility. Part of the objective of OPEC, as I said, is to give the impression of being a more secure supplier of oil at reasonable prices. That's the stability side. But stability, if you're thinking about an oil producer who wants to have access to more market, both through increased demand and decreasing supply from competitive sources of production, you prefer a little bit of volatility in the system. Because if you were to say today to a company who would be exploring for oil and producing oil in Alaska or in other parts of the world, the price will always be right around $18 a barrel. And with very little volatility, every oil company in the world can plan for that and plan successfully its own cash flow and leverage against such an opportunity. the volatility is important to put into question the relative stability of a price, so that if you're becoming comfortable with today's $23 oil and tomorrow goes to 18, you may begin to wonder again about forward prices and your own investment profile. It doesn't stop you from investing. What it does do is it slows down your investment profile. And every year you slow down developing a field outside of OPEC is a year longer. OPEC produces the oil and has access to the market and will maintain access to that market. The other paradox in today's market is what I call competition with cooperation. The best example of this is OPEC and non-OPEC cooperation, or what we call the IPEC countries, the independent producing and exporting countries, of which some aren't countries, some are states and provinces. The competition is important because it's the message that we want to cooperate. The message is also strong that OPEC will cooperate if the independent producers make the first move and make moves. The message is very clear now that OPEC itself will not cut back its volume anymore. There's no need to. It's up to someone else to cut back if it's required to happen. So but also it's the issue of OPEC itself has different member countries who are integrating downstream, who from a production side are cooperating to control production in a relative sense. But at the same time, through downstream integration, buying refineries, buying gasoline stations, are guaranteeing for themselves that whatever happens to the volume of production, agree to or not agree to, they'll have access to the end-use market. And that's a competitive element. Also, one must remember that oil is in competition with other fuels. And they want to maintain this cooperation among oil producers so that oil has a relatively higher price than it would do otherwise, but not to the extent that it loses market against other fuels. The best way to think about that is right now, oil is not competitive with natural gas. If you were moving into the fourth quarter of this year, when we have the large increase in demand for seasonal reasons, and a lot of it could go either towards gas or oil, at today's oil price, natural gas can move from $1.50, which is more or less is on a spot market basis, to over $2.25, and still be competitive with oil in a strong sense. That's a message that I think the oil price is somewhat out of bounds. And when we get to that period in time, OPEC doesn't want to be priced quite that high against natural gas because it loses potential market share that it might not have otherwise. Those are two paradoxes that I think say to us that OPEC itself is trying to change the boundaries in which the oil market moves. A year ago, I sat here with you and said that the range in which prices would move in 1988 would be $12 to $18 for the OPEC barrel. My $12 is the OPEC barrel, not WTI or anything else, and 18 is the OPEC barrel. And we said the average price would be somewhere around $14 to $15. People thought, well, that's easy to forecast, the price would move between 12 and 18. Well, it wasn't so much to say that, you know, we're taking an easy course out, it was to say, this is what you have to plan on, it's going to be a very volatile market. That was the message of $12 to $18. And guess what? It did move between $12 and $18, it went to $12 twice and $18 twice over the course of a year. And that is a very difficult movement for a company to deal with if you were planning on a more stable price profile. Sitting here now, looking out and thinking about the new OPEC and this more cooperative atmosphere they're in, thinking about demand, how it is a little more robust than originally thought a year ago, one would say that the range is narrowing, that for the OPEC barrel in the calendar year, I say calendar year rather than your fiscal year, this calendar year, the OPEC barrel will move between a $14 barrel and a $17 barrel. And I think with an average price more towards a $16 barrel for the calendar year 1989. Currently, the OPEC barrel is over $19. That's a result of the second action, the action of this week with respect to Brent. Prices will stay high for a few months, given that there's a hole that needs to be filled due to the lost Alaskan production that has not been filled yet. That will be filled in a few weeks' time. There's now a hole that needs to be filled because of lost Brent production. That will not be filled for 3 to 4 weeks yet. Once those holes are filled, we still only have our inventories at levels below last year's levels. And given that I couldn't forecast a year ago the benign accidents in the supply system, neither could any major oil company. Having now lived through 9 accidents, most major oil companies are going to say, once I've filled those holes that have been created by the Alaskan problem and the Brent problem, I'm going to want to increase my inventories even more because I don't want to be caught out yet once again. And don't forget, these companies have been caught short three or four times now in 4 months, and that's pretty dear, as they say. So I think we're looking at the OPEC barrel this calendar year moving in a range of 14 to 17. That's significant. It narrows the movement of volatility by over 30%. It's still volatile, still makes you think about your forward investment profile if you're a company that produces oil and wants to, but it's a good deal narrower than it was a year ago. When we're thinking today about the oil market, before Brent happened 2 or 3 days ago, OPEC had been averaging for the month of April about 21 million barrels a day. They have a quota they've agreed among themselves of 18.5 million barrels a day. Just so you know, no one paid any attention to the fact that OPEC was producing 21 million barrels a day. But Brent happened, and very smartly OPEC announced that they would probably increase their production to make up for the supply shortfalls. A very smart marketing move on their part. Because no one had paid attention to the fact they're overproducing anyhow. Now the oil market needs more oil, so they're solving the problem. This is the new OPEC, right, called the Madison Avenue OPEC. Very smart marketing campaign. It was a brilliant move. But they were producing 21 million barrels a day up until before Brent happened because a number of producers in OPEC were nervous. Nervous that the price, even before Brent happened, was getting too high. Why were they nervous about that? They want to find themselves not only having strong demand in 1988, last year, but they want to have strong demand for the oil in 1989. They want to have strong demand for the oil in 1990 and 1992. They were getting concerned that prices were moving too high or could go too high and affect their demand. This is a little picture to try to give a ballpark indication of different price levels for the OPEC barrel, $18, $15, and $12, and how that affects demand. And we show you next to the column percentage rate of growth in world oil demand at those relative price levels. And we show you on the axis what that means in volume terms. And you can see quite clearly at $18 OPEC oil, which is $20 WTI, West Texas Intermediate, demand would grow in the world at about 1 to 1.5%. We know from 1988, when oil prices from OPEC averaged, in the second half of the year, around $12 a barrel, for the whole year, around 14, demand was growing at 2.5% plus in 1988. And the difference between those two percentage rates of growth is very big if you think about it, and you're OPEC. I'm OPEC, I want to produce my oil, it's no good to me in the ground. The difference is about 1 million to 1.5 million barrels a day demand for my production. And that's what the difference in the prices mean to those countries. Every half percentage point is 300,000 barrels a day. That's a lot of oil in the system. Equally, if you keep the price volatile between these price levels, you then begin to slow down non-OPEC production to some extent. You don't knock it out, you just slow it down. And every barrel less than non-OPEC produces is interpreted as 2 barrels for me, OPEC. It doesn't add up quite right. That's how it's interpreted in a perceptual sense by OPEC. And this is where they're coming from, this is what they're thinking about. Why were they now, in early April, getting concerned the price was too high? Well, the original estimates, not forecasts now, the original estimates at the end of March, mid-March, for first quarter demand in the OECD were just over 2% growth. Well, the U.S. may now well be revising down its own demand numbers for the first quarter, down closer towards 1%. The OECD, who collects the data on a developed country's consumption, is about to revise down, to some extent, numbers for Western Europe as well. There is a concern about demand not being as robust as one had thought. The best way to solve that problem is to try and get the price back down to some extent. So you don't change consumer psychology. What consumers continue to think the price is low and attractive. That's hard to fight against right now, given that the price of gasoline in the U.S. just went above a dollar, well above a dollar. The price of gasoline in the U.S., in terms of the basket, your purchasing power and your percentage of your own income is at all-time lows. But it went through a psychological barrier called $1, which is affecting certainly consumer attitude in the lower 48 of the U.S. anyhow. We're looking at demand this year, if prices come back down from today's highs by a couple of dollars on average over the rest of the year, for demand to grow just under 2%. We're looking at demand to grow in calendar year 1990 at about 1.5%, or just a little bit lower, given we have economic growth coming down in 1990 compared to 1989. If we look at non-OPEC supply, it continues to grow. Even with cooperation by 7 or 8 independent producing countries, we have non-OPEC production this year about 200,000 barrels a day higher than last year for the year on average. Now that could be affected if there is more cooperation in the second half of the year by non-OPEC with OPEC. It also depends very much what's happening in Brent right now, the Brent field in the North Sea. If that is out of production for a good part of this quarter, that growth in non-OPEC production will not occur this year compared to a year earlier. If you look further out, you have non-OPEC production growing in 1990 over 89 by a couple hundred thousand barrels a day again. As you go further out, you have the potential for non-OPEC to grow modestly into the early 1990s and then coming off a bit in the mid-1990s, but still being at today's levels. What we have right now is the opportunity for OPEC this year to be producing about 20 million barrels a day, maybe 21 million barrels a day. If we look into 1990, the opportunity is for around the same number, 21 million barrels a day or so in 1990. What does that mean for OPEC itself and its own meetings it's having in June and December? We expect that when OPEC meets June 5th, which I believe is the scheduled date of the meeting, that OPEC will be discussing primarily one objective, which is raising their quota. The quota currently is 18.5. We think they'll raise the quota to at least 19.5, if not 20 million barrels a day. They will discuss whether or not they should raise the official price objective from $18 to $19, or maybe $18 to $20. As of this point in time, I think there's a great deal of reluctance to raise the price objective. I think the consensus, if I can use the term consensus, a number of key players, as I call them within OPEC, are more keen not to touch the official price objective, to leave it at $18 until the end of 1990, to see indeed if they have consolidated the gains on the demand side and the market share that they feel they have and would like to consolidate and maintain the system. I think it's important not raising the objective from the demand point of view. When the price fell in 1986 from $34 towards that $18 number and lower, we did touch $9 for a while. We touched $10 or $11, but no one ever witnessed or felt $9 or $10. No sooner than it hit those low levels, we were told OPEC had gotten back together and we're going to put the price of oil back on the path to $18 and then $20. So psychology didn't really change. Once we move into 87, 88, when price went from $18 and the objective of $18 was never reached, it went to $12 and stayed there for 6 months, then you begin to realize even when the price goes back to 18, it's a very low price. There's not much difference between 12 and 18. But if you begin to send signals to the marketplace that we're about to raise an objective from 18 to 19 and then maybe to 20, that begins to change the perception of the consumer about where prices may go, and they may get high again. It was interesting to watch one of your television programs last night, a news report that was photographing the New York Mercantile Exchange in New York, where the price of gasoline is just going through the roof and the price of oil is going towards $23. And these floor traders are shouting and trying to buy their contracts. And they interview a couple floor traders in New York. And the floor traders are saying the price of gasoline is really high. We have to start encouraging conservation and efficiency again in America, reduce our dependence on oil, which is really amazing to hear. That's what affects consumer psychology. When you see on 6 o'clock news, or whatever time it is here, on a national network, that the price of oil is going up, price of gasoline is going up, that really affects consumer psychology. Not so much that the price actually did go up or not, but to hear the message being pounded home at you. And that could well happen if we raise that price objective. And OPEC's aware of that. They want to, as I say, consolidate demand. The best way to do that is to raise volume, not to raise price. When you look at the June meeting, most people suspect and feel the biggest obstacle to a smooth meeting is Iraq and an Iraqi demand for a quota of 3.5 million barrels a day. I feel quite confident that Iraq will go to the meeting and sit around a table like this and put before the meeting a demand for 3.5 million barrels a day for a quota. But I think it's negotiable. It is not non-negotiable. They have to make that demand, but it's a good bargaining point to start from. First of all, they can't export the oil anyhow if they produce it. Everyone knows that. They will not argue hard for it. They will argue hard for 3.5 million barrels a day come December, because in 1990 they can produce and export the equivalent of 3.5 million barrels a day, but not now. The biggest obstacle and stumbling block is the United Arab Emirates, who have on the table already a demand for a quota of 1.5 million barrels a day. They feel they have a special case. The UAE is a federation of seven principalities. Three of those principalities produce oil. Only one of those principalities pays the bills for the entire federation. That's Abu Dhabi. When Abu Dhabi and UAE first agreed to quotas within OPEC back in March of 83, they were the only principality producing oil. The other two were not. Now we have two left producing oil, and it's hard to say who agreed to the quota in 1983. Was it Abu Dhabi or was it the UAE? But now the UAE has a quota that doesn't accommodate the new structure of production in the Federation. They're using that argument as a special case to allow them to raise their quota to 1.5. I think they'll probably get their way. If they cannot agree to the UAE demand for 1.5, all OPEC will do is roll over the current quota of 18.5. If they do that, that's an admission of inability to solve the quota allocation problem, which may, in the short term, put the price right up. But a few weeks after the meeting, the price will come right down because everyone will be going for their own volume in an unallocated, unorganized fashion. As I say, I think the diplomatic efforts have been made and are being made to settle the UAE problem. And I think the best way to settle it is to set a quota of 20 million barrels a day, because adding 1.5 to the quota, giving 500,000 barrels a day to UAE, leaves you 1 million barrels a day for the others, which can be shared, I think, reasonably well. Come December, you're dealing with an Iraqi demand for a 3.5 million barrel a day quota, an Iraqi non-negotiable position of 3.2 million barrels a day. If they don't get 3.2, they'll produce 3.2. And they're going to fight hard for 3.2. That would mean, if they were given that increase, a 600,000 barrel a day increase to Iraq going into 1990. If they got that, Iran would be entitled to the same quota increase. That would be over 1 million barrels a day of a quota increase, which would leave very little for others in OPEC to have, even if you're optimistic about your assumption on demand growth and on the world economy. That means the discussion in December this year will be very difficult. Could be resolved. The best way to resolve it is to have one or two large producers, such as Saudi Arabia or Kuwait, say, we'll give you the higher quota, but everyone has to then be very disciplined around their quota so we can try and average the price up to some extent in early 1990. A very difficult game to play on the whole, especially when you're moving into a period in which the consensus, and I use the term quite strongly, the consensus of forecasters about world economic growth are now becoming less optimistic about 1990. If we're less optimistic about 1990 world economic growth, that would mean oil demand growth would be less robust in 1990, and even harder for a quota increase of 1 million barrels a day to find a marketplace at an $18 price objective. How would I summarize all this in price for your fiscal year, 1990, not my calendar years? As I look at the rest of this fiscal year for you, which is 89, I would say prices stay at very firm and high levels for most of the rest of this quarter, given those two holes, the Alaskan hole in the supply system and the Brent hole in the supply system, have not yet been filled. It'll take time to fill them. And even then, we're going to want to build more inventories than we had beforehand, given all those accidents. I would say we're looking at this second quarter, WTI price at around the $21 number. That would put Brent North Sea at around $20 and OPEC at around $19 for this quarter. I would think the buying pressure on the whole and desire to build primary inventories would stay strong into the third quarter. We're still well below a year ago level of inventories. That would mean for me a WTI price around $19 to $20, maybe edging below $19 in the third quarter. That would put OPEC oil at around $17 or just a little bit lower in the third quarter. The fourth quarter, I would put the OPEC barrel more like $16 a barrel. It's a little bit lower. That's the important period in which they want to get more demand in the system. That's when the marginal demand is there because of the seasonal upturn in demand, and they need to have a little bit lower price against natural gas to be competitive with natural gas in those markets in the fourth quarter. The first half of next year, I'd be looking at an OPEC barrel somewhere around the $15 to $16 number, given the difficulty, I think, with the quota discussion in December, given that demand may be weaker due to economic growth in 1990, and given the inability, if the quotas can't be resolved properly, to stay near a quota rather than well above quota in the first half of 1990. And I would expect, if there are no accidents in the system, that we'd see the normal seasonal downturn in prices in the second quarter of next year, which we haven't seen this year. We've seen the reverse because of accidents. That would, for me, bring the average OPEC price down to the $15 to $16 number in the first half of next year, which would put you right around $16 for the OPEC barrel for your fiscal year. And if I understand the differentials correctly between ANS and the OPEC basket, that'd be around 15-ish. I think maybe a little bit better than 15 for your fiscal year 1990. There are two accidents that could happen to alter the price in the fourth quarter of this year, and they're totally unpredictable. One is a very cold winter, fourth quarter season in North America, and that would affect natural gas deliverability and availability, and that could then push natural gas prices a lot higher and make oil more competitive even at today's levels of prices. But it's very difficult to forecast cold winters or mild winters at this point in time. But that's the one if to really watch for. It can give a bigger push to fourth quarter prices. Now, I don't want to be forecasting any more accidents in the system on the whole for all of our sakes. I think with that, I'll close and leave it to you for questions or comments.
Thank you, Dr. Stanislaw. I'm sure there'll be questions from the table here. You're probably aware that, I don't know if you had a chance to look over the memo from our Legislative Finance Division, which we have copies which can be handed out at the table. On that memo, we should have copies here in a second. They're talking about a revision in some of the price projections that we've been doing here. If you look, you can see under the mid-case scenario for the Department of Revenue, I believe it's based on $15.66 a barrel for 1990. Is that a pretty safe number in your opinion, that we could use for FY90?
Well, given that my view of the... Unfortunately, I usually think in OPEC terms.
Okay.
I should try to change my mentality a bit, but it's hard for me. I guess it's old age. But I think in terms of the OPEC barrel being around that $16 number, maybe just a hair below it. If I'm correct on the normal differential between ANS and the OPEC basket, I say normal given the past month has been totally askew, and the way I understand these averages being created by delivery point, that I think I would be leaning a little bit lower than 1566, given the differential I think is a little bit broader than that. I think the difference is a lot broader than 40 cents between my basket and the ANS, your definition. My understanding is it's about 75 cents or so, and that would push it more towards 1525, but that's nitpicking, taking dimes and nickels.
Okay. There's also been... the question about cheating at OPEC, do you think that cheating is pretty much under control at this point, or is that going to continue, or is it pretty much under control? I mean, that obviously has an impact on what's going on.
Without question. Cheating is a very difficult concept, and maybe it's better called overproduction. And I think both OPEC and the marketplace itself prefer to think in terms of overproduction, because both OPEC and the market itself are becoming more sophisticated to understand that even if OPEC were a perfect organization, a perfect cartel, and it set a quota of 18.5, let's say, we all know we can't forecast demand perfectly. We all know we can't forecast accidents being there or not perfectly. But there will be something that throws off the ability to stay at that quota or not, and extra demands for oil or less demands for the oil. So that one understands well that from time to time people will need to overproduce. But equally, the market understands, and OPEC understands, that it's important to manage the process. Manage in the sense of saying what our minimum level of production will be, that will be our quota right now, and leave enough room above that quota for those who have a difficulty staying at quota from time to time, for whatever reason, to be able to go into the market and exercise some flexibility as a nation, some flexibility as a national oil company, to have access to a market. As long as it's within reasonable bounds, OPEC accepts it, and the market accepts it. Now, when OPEC set the quota of 18.5, we went to you and said they're never going to produce 18.5. 18.5 means 19 minimum, if not 19.5. So far, they've averaged, up until 3 weeks ago, 19.5 million barrels a day. When I say I expect OPEC will meet in June and set a new quota of 19.5, if not 20 million barrels a day, that means OPEC will produce 20.5 or 21 million barrels a day. That's tolerable and acceptable to the marketplace, and tolerable and acceptable to OPEC in its understanding of the liquidity around the edges of oil production.
Questions, Senator Fakes? No questions? And are there other questions, Senator Halford? I think we passed out this memo, which sort of indicates where the Department of Revenue essentially came up with some figures here, and I believe you said the $15.25 was a pretty reasonable figure that could be used on that. With the Valdez oil spill and with this catastrophe on in the North Sea, that, in your opinion, that has had a definite effect on what the pricing is with the raising of gasoline prices in the lower 48, and how is that affecting our pricing of oil? Obviously, it's making it go up.
Well, up until 2 days ago when the Brent accident happened, and again, we don't quite know the extent of the Brent accident, the British government was supposed to make an announcement today at close of business their time. They did not. They may be making it later tonight as to what's going on there. But up until then, it was putting a premium into the NS price as well as the WTI price for obvious reasons. It's the crude that was cut off. It's one that's most desired because it's tied into refineries that like using it or geared up to it. So it has a premium. It did have a premium. The premium disappeared to some extent with the Brent announcement. And not entirely, but to some extent it did. The premiums are going to go away, both on the ANS side and WTI side with respect to Brent, and the Brent premium will go away once those holes are filled. But it'll keep up our demand in a strong way for an ANS, for WTI, for Brent, because those are the crudes we like to use in our refineries in North America. Yes, I can buy a lot more Kuwaiti crude. I can buy a lot more Venezuelan crude, but it's not the crude I normally run through my refinery. I make a lot more money in my refinery that's geared up to running a special type of crude than I do switching back and forth because of relative prices. So you're going to find more of those buyers who normally buy and use Brent, WTI, and ANS trying to buy more of it to build their inventories in case there's another accident comes along. Because it's expensive for them to lose that supply. Yes, they can replace it, but it's the wrong crude for the refinery. I should say, maybe it's off the record, I should say, I think it's more coincidental the price of gasoline rose when they did rise than it was the plan or conspiracy or action on the part of any oil company. If you just think about what was happening in the world oil market since October, November, don't forget in October, November, OPEC prices were $11.50 or $12 a barrel. Where were the Texas prices? $14 a barrel, $14.50, $15. Where were they up until March 24th? They'd gone to over $20 a barrel. They'd increased $6 or $7 a barrel. And you know what happened to gasoline prices in between? Nothing. Gasoline prices hadn't moved. The lag was very long and very slow. Now one has to ask why the lag was so long, because it moved a lot faster in Europe on the price side. But the lag was long. They were going to move some point in time, and I think it's just an unfortunate coincidence of circumstances that they all moved when they did move. And the Alaskan spill just made it even more dramatic that those product prices were out of line with underlying crude prices.
On the memo, also dated April 14th, one other question. I don't know if there are other questions from members at the table, but now it looks like under the Department of Revenue's March 1980 high case scenario, which they're saying is likely, that we're going to be looking at a surplus of $134 million this year. And you may not be able to comment on our actual budgeting sort of situation, but it does indicate that whenever these projections are done, I believe, from the Department of Revenue, when the price stays up at a high point, the average sort of catches up with it. So this projection might have been done a month ago, and we may be technically at a lot higher dollar level on the price per barrel than was indicated a month ago. Would that be your consensus?
Oh, I think so, yes. Your price has been a good deal higher in the past 3 weeks than it was previously, our expectations of it. And it's going to be that good deal higher the rest of this quarter, given, as I said, those holes will not be filled. So I think it does bring the average up. I don't know how much it brings the average up. I haven't seen the numbers compared to what it was before, but it does definitely lift it without question. It's a full 4 months of the planning period. That's one-third of the planning period. That has a big impact on averages.
And, of course, we don't really know this, and I don't really know the technicalities of our projection computer formula, but it'd be interesting to know if there was something built into the fluctuation of the normal downward seasonal trend. In other words, in the projection, it might have been projected
lower.
That it was going to be lower in the spring, and therefore, now that it has not gone into that low period, it may be even more of a surplus than what we believe.
I would be surprised. That's the wrong word. I would probably think that in the system used, they would have some seasonal downturn in prices in the second quarter. That's been the history of the market for many years now. That, as I said earlier, that's